Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you are listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you would love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guests are Dean Sharp and Salem El-Quadwa to talk about their book, Open Gaza, Architectures of Hope. Salem is shelter manager for the Gaza Strip, as well as a conflict and peace fellow at Harvard University. Dean is the co-director of Terraform and an LSC fellow in geography and environment at the London School of Economics and Political Science. Thank you both for being here with me today and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brian. Great to be with you.
Thank you, Brian. It's a pleasure.
Right, so before we start, I gave a quick snippet. Could you both kind of tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Absolutely. So I'm an urban geographer based at the London School of Economics, and I've been working on urban questions around the Middle East for over 15 years now. This is my second co-edited book and an outcome of a decade of work with Michael Sorkin, who's obviously a very well-known architect and prolific writer and scholar around urban questions as well, and the question of the right to the city in particular, public space and spatial justice. And my work with him was also at Terraform, that was an organization that he set up in 2005, that basically took on unsolicited projects of questions that focused around urban equity, justice, and sustainability. And these kinds of unsolicited projects, often with very little funding, would intervene in situations like Gaza, and then engage communities and scholars working in those kinds of places and connect with people like Salem.
Thank you, Dean. Actually, I am a Palestinian architect based in Gaza, and I have more than 15 years of experience from a senior level project management and implementation position in a humanitarian context, disaster preparedness, emergency response and recovery projects in the Gaza Strip, Palestine. Houses and water and sanitation were essential part of each project that I have managed with a deep commitment to providing healthy environment for communities in needs, mainly in rural and marginalized areas in the Gaza Strip. So I worked for 2 years and a half with the Ministry of Finance on a World Bank funded projects in relation to procurement. In addition to that, I joined Islamic Relief Worldwide in 2006 as the emergency manager working on affordable housing and reconstructing families that have been displaced from their houses in Gaza. So while working with three international NGOs, I wrote grant proposals and helped to manage seasonal and domestic events, as well as seven reconstruction projects with a total value of more than $5 million, ranging from primary healthcare clinics and schools to the rehabilitation of houses for families in need. So I kept working with communities, I mean, on the grounds for more than 10 years. And in 2015, I started my PhD by design journey at Oxford School of Architecture, Oxford Brookes University in England, the UK. And recently I have been awarded a fellowship to be a conflict and peace fellow at Harvard Divinity School for this academic year. Ryan.
Very interesting. And so, both of your backgrounds will come across in the book quite a bit. And so, the first question, especially when dealing with kind of these edited books that have so many different viewpoints, every chapter is very unique and has kind of a different focus. But, not to make this too vague of a question, maybe you could walk us through a little bit of the overall theme of the book.
Absolutely. Thanks, Brian. The first thing to say was that this book was a direct reaction to the 2014 operation on Gaza by Israel called Operation Protective Edge. Michael Sorkin was the initiator of this project, who was morally outraged by the violence that was unleashed. And this was the third major assault on Gaza in 6 years by Israel. And it pushed a context that the UN had already declared by 2020 it would be uninhabitable to ever deeper depths of despair. But the impetus for the book was not to document the devastation and suffering of Gaza, which many other organizations do quite systematically, and the dire state is quite known. What Michael wanted to do was to think of productive interventions that could be brought about by Terraform's community of designers, planners, scholars, and activists. And after a series of roundtables, and Salem can perhaps touch upon some of the early ones that I wasn't actually even involved with, that happened at the University of Westminster and his own connection with Michael. But the idea was to, through a series of roundtables and individual dialogues and research initiatives with Terraform's community, to really think about what the type of productive interventions could be created. And then Michael led a Terraform intervention that imagined a more just and sustainable future for Gaza, and then brought this conversation together, of which, as the director of Terraform and a long-term interlocutor with Michael, I have brought in more of the social science aspects, with anthropologists, political scientists, and geographers such as myself, also intervening through both creating analyses of the dire conditions, but also imaginative interventions of what Gaza could be if people were given their basic right to the city. So that was very much the scope of the book. And then this is also reflected in the types of contributions that are in it, that come from very grounded interventions. And Salem will speak a bit more about, for instance, his own work in low-cost housing construction, and there's also a school by the architect Omar Youssef. Mm-hmm. But then there are imaginative projects by Rafi Segal, for instance, on the solar dome that's imagining a solar energy system for Gaza, or the Internet Pigeon Network by Helga Tawil-Suri that imagines an Israeli-free, low-technological way of ensuring that Gaza is connected to the wider world beyond the logics of the occupation. And then, of course, things like the tunnels that show the journey that one of the contributors went from the border in Egypt into Gaza, and these incredible engineering feats that have been produced to, again, circumvent some of the deleterious effects of the blockade.
Absolutely. And so we won't go through this linearly, we never do, but I think the very first chapter, we'll call it Gaza's Skin, kind of addresses, I guess, the problem that all of these are kind of responding to, and that is the idea that it is enclosed physically, conceptually, emotionally. And again, I guess, as I admitted before we started recording, that I had a very macro level view of what's going on there, whereas reading stuff like this is a little jarring. Particularly, I'd like to hear more about it, the fact that it's very technologically advanced, this very smart city and this fence, but not in the way that I think most of us think of as a smart city.
Yeah, absolutely. Salem, maybe I could pass to you to answer some of the everyday context of Gaza that you're, I think, far more well positioned to answer.
Yes, thank you so much for your very good question, Brian, at the beginning. I just want to highlight, how the project was initiated, because mainly I was based in Gaza as a Palestinian citizen living with my family and with the rest of the Palestinian population. So during and after that 2014 Operation Protective Edge, which was the third major Israeli assault on Gaza in less than 6 years, I was in contact with a group of architects based in London. And I'm so thankful for Ib Haim, Nasser Golzari, and Yara Sharif from the University of Westminster, who introduced my work for the first time for the late Michael Sorkin. So when I moved to the UK in 2015, it was a great chance to meet Michael for the first time, and even to get the chance of presenting my work in the first Open Gaza conference, which took place on November 2015 at the University of Westminster. So during that time, I think the meeting itself, the conference, this kind of different theme that each and every presenter presented at his presentation and talk initiated the idea of having a book project about Gaza and the urgency of dealing with the realities over there in Gaza. So in terms of the imagination, you are absolutely right. The book is a nice collection or a unique collection of works. Some of them are very imaginative because we as architects and designers, we need to experiment with things. We need to imagine the future of the people over there. And in other words, also other chapters and contributions are dealing with within the reality of the Gaza Strips. For example, as you mentioned that the first chapter is The Skin of Gaza of Tariq Bakuni. My second chapter or the second contribution is my own chapter where I'm trying to go beneath the skin of the everyday and to reveal, what's going on, in terms of the everyday life. So, for example, I offer a visual analysis of the existing objects that surrounds the Gaza inhabitants and the buildings in which they and I myself live with my family. And this is, by the way, followed by a social and physical mapping exercises that I did extensively while working with local communities and also offering a design-based case study for one of my projects that I have coordinated from inception to completion to show how this kind of extension or by offering this kind of minimum shelter and housing solution could help local communities to improve their life over there.
And that's a great segue. You had mentioned the chapter where you discuss, you know, the architectural work you had done. You know, I'll be honest. So when I first read it and you see the images and there's a discussion of the dismal unemployment rate. And so, you know, sadly, the first thing I thought of was, well, hell, construction would be a perfect way to rebuild the city and employ people. But then reading it, it's very clear that there's a reason construction isn't happening at a large scale. And I think our listeners would be shocked to hear whether it's the limitation of materials, the poorly performance of those materials.
Yeah, exactly. So you are touching a very important thing in terms of material or the existence and the entry of material, or what's so-called, the moral minimalism, because, you know, Israel is having a full control over the Gaza Strip with less, responsibility. So they are offering everything in the minimum standard, the entry of construction material. And on the top of that, you know, reconstruction and destruction and reconstruction are taking place at the same time. So you could imagine each and every 2 years, we are having this kind of attacks on most of the population on the Gaza Strip. So reconstruction and destruction is taking place at the same time. What I'm offering over here is to have this kind of, work with communities, to be a good listener to our clients and having also the social responsibility while working on such sensitive projects, because you are not dealing with a client, who could offer you a certain amount of money rather than working with communities in need. So the second part of the chapter, which is a design-based case study, I'm telling the audience into details how we could help those communities in order to expand their houses in such, an incremental way while having the social and the cultural concerns into consideration as well.
Absolutely. And you had mentioned kind of modernism, but then you also discussed the fact that everything there is built with a human perspective. It's more about survival and functionalism versus an architectural style. And
this is absolutely right. So I'll give you one funny example. One foreigner once entered Gaza and he said, "Wow, what a nice gray building you have." He thought that we do have a construction boom, but based on the necessity, most of the population could not finish or rehabilitate their houses themselves because of, I mean, the bad economic situation due to the Israeli blockade, which is more than 13 years right now. And we do have also electricity cut off more than 20 hours per day. And we have insufficient access to clean water. So you could imagine all those factors, how they are forcing people to build to the minimum standards, which are not acceptable. And sometimes even it's below the minimum standards. So the second part of the chapter is offering this kind of design-based case study and how to include the communities within the process of rebuilding their society, rather than forcing them to accept, I mean, the international charity or the international NGO, I mean, vision such as the mud house or the shelter bag or the sandbag or the wooden shelters. And I might leave it to Dean also to talk a little bit about this kind of reconstruction violence, which is taking place rapidly in the region as well.
Yeah, Salim, thanks. Salim touches on a point in terms of my own broader work. I'm working also on a book called Reconstruction as Violence, The Case of Syria, that has also strong parallels to what we're seeing in Gaza, and many of the chapters touch upon this Gaza reconstruction mechanism that was a tripart agreement established by the Palestinian Authority, the Israelis, and the United Nations. And many of the contributors detail how, far from any reconstruction process, this reconstruction mechanism is actually enforcing and entrenching the blockade and further immiseration of Gazans, rather than any kind of positive rebuilding sense. And there are certainly parallels and the furious debates that are going on in the context of Syria at the moment as to whether reconstruction happens. And we've already seen very early how the reconstruction process has become very much a part of how warfare is conducted, hence the title Reconstruction as Violence, which was also a conference I put on in MIT a couple of years ago. And it also speaks to many contexts across the region, in Libya, Yemen, Iraq, of course, in Afghanistan, and so on. You've all had very long now reconstruction processes that are really stretching the terminology and our conceptual understanding of what reconstruction actually consists of, and the way in which the built environment can be weaponized, and this larger urbanization of violence and warfare that we've witnessed over the past 20 to 30 years.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So to add to that, Ryan, just to make it, I mean, more clear for our American audience, let me bring this example in order to let them, imagine how a typical building looks like. So before, describing how we are used to live in Gaza or in the region, I would like to highlight the following fact that during the last year and even this year and even before the pandemic, millions of young people in the United States and America between the age of 23 and 38 returned to live with their parents. For some of them, it was, a choice, but for most of them, it was a necessity simply because of the unemployment. They could not offer anymore to rent a house or to rent an apartment. And you know, there's the rest of the story over here in the United States. In Gaza, because of the extended family system, we used to live with each other. For example, a typical building, let us imagine a section. My grandparents are living in the ground floor because it's easier for them to have access and to receive visitors. In the first floor and the second floor, their married sons. And in the third floor and the fourth floor, if someone of their grandchildren are going to marry, so they used to add this kind of incremental, one room or one typical floor on the top of that. And you'll see the naked columns with steel bars coming on the top of the building. It's called the Columns of Hope because, you could easily read the story of the building that it's an incremental one and it will keep growing, according to the family expansion. So when the Israelis are destroying this kind of typical building, they're not only destroying the physical structure itself, I mean the building, rather than tearing out the social fabric of the extended families. And over here, the international NGOs are coming to offer this kind of transitional shelter, which is the mud house or the sandbag shelter or the wooden shelter, which is not suitable or responding to the sociocultural, I mean, norms of the families over there. And also because of its, I mean, cost and the availability of material in relation to the blockade against the Gaza Strip. So I hope that description highlighted the importance of including the community within the process, as Dean just described right now, not in Gaza, but also considering Gaza as a unique example for the reconstruction process in the rest of the region, such as Syria, Yemen, Iraq, and Libya.
That was great. And I actually want, there's one point I'd like to talk about, and I do want to come back to relating something to our American experience. But you had just touched on the, you know, there was a point in the book I found very interesting, and that's as people in the Gaza Strip, when you're dealing with your hierarchy of needs, as the focus is more on survival and basic necessities, you lose what you call social cohesion. And so you had mentioned in the book, it talks about how there's almost this shame of guilt or sorrow, which
exactly.
And again, I personally had not heard about that. And I think that's something that brings to light kind of this problem.
Exactly. It's this kind of total dependency on humanitarian aid, because most of the people are surviving, I mean, from day to day. And, you know, because of the COVID pandemic as well, it creates a pandemic within a pandemic because of the overcrowding over there. And you are asking people to stay at their homes. I mean, it's like, I mean, giving them an order to stay in a gas room, because simply overcrowding is creating a problem. We do have limited access to open and public spaces. So it's creating a pandemic within a pandemic. And in terms of shelter and housing, we are still also depending on humanitarian aid, international NGOs. So considering the everyday life and the contribution of the people, it's a way of giving back dignity to the society and to empower the local people themselves.
Right. And so the point I wanted to come back to, you know, as you're relating some of this to our American experience, there's a few chapters that talk about the idea of planning. And again, I'll let my own bias as a practicing architect shine through. You know, dealing with planning boards can be a bit of a nuisance, but it is part of our process. Whereas in here, it's presented as a solution, because not to oversimplify it, it sounds like there literally is no planning endeavors in Gaza.
Yes, exactly. Planning is totally missing, simply because people could not plan for next month or for next year. Simply attacks could take place at any moment. So planning is totally missing. And even the real meaning of architecture, I mean, being a shelter, protection, and even freeing people both mentally and psychologically, is totally missing. Simply buildings could be a weapon to kill people rather than to be a machine to live. And I think Dean could highlight also the importance of planning and the loss of planning at that place as well.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there's always this tension between top down and bottom up. But of course, without any top down planning at all, you do get the situation of deliberate confusion, chaos, and you can't have mechanisms to resolve one of the most important issues that human society brings, which is who can live where, how, and under what conditions. So planning, of course, is absolutely essential, but, you know, too much of it can obviously be incredibly oppressive, and none at all equally. I think it shows in this context can also be a form of organized violence as well. And, you know, the deliberate obstacles that are placed in the creation of a planning system, of ensuring that cadastrals are not clearly defined, is, you know, a way of ensuring that a society is continually fractured and divided. And the complexities of those social systems that really get illuminated in a case like Gaza, and I hope comes through the book as well.
I believe it does. So speaking of kind of long-term planning and consequences, there's something you had mentioned earlier in this interview, and it's brought up a few times in the book, and that is that UN had released at least one or multiple reports kind of proving that by 2020, Gaza will be completely unsustainable and unlivable. And so I personally was very interested because we're now in 2021. And so the first thing that came to my mind is, well, how is Gaza doing? As simple of a question as that is.
The situation in Gaza is still the same. I mean, 2020, 2021, and being away from Gaza, I thought that the situation is going to be the same, but it dramatically changed from 1 month to another. So we're still facing this kind of lack of access to clean water and the electricity cut off as well. And as I told you before, the pandemic, the COVID-19, and asking people to stay at their houses is completely dangerous. And also it's creating another layer of social problems. I mean, this kind of domestic abuse, the high rate of unemployment for younger people over there. So still the situation is getting worse year by year. So I think the Open Gaza book is a unique project that is calling for the freedom of the Palestinian people and the freedom of people to move from one place to another, and also to have free access to materials, to resources, similar to other places in this world.
And just to add to what Salem was saying, and also your question, Brian, I think it's important to emphasize the fact that many of those UN reports, and the famous one around Gaza being uninhabitable in 2020, was actually written in 2012, which was 2 years before Operation Protected Edge. That right. Left observers like Sarah Roy, who's been going back and forth to Gaza for over 30 years and wrote the preface of the book, was left utterly shocked at what she saw. And maybe Salem could also elaborate on what it was like being in Gaza at the time, because he was also living there. So just to say that, you know, obviously the suffering and deprivation there has reached ever greater depths, but to bring to Open Gaza and this idea of architectures of hope, you know, we wanted exactly this, to get remarkable people like Salem and display the work that he's doing despite the challenges, to show the schools that exist and the architectural achievements that are still being done in these oppressive and devastating contexts, and to highlight that this is not an intractable problem going on in Gaza. Israel could lift the siege tomorrow. They could allow cement in. They could allow people to rebuild. The Palestinians, you know, have some of the highest literacy rates in the world. They are skilled engineers and architects. Most of the Middle East is built by Palestinians. They are an incredibly skilled community. And that this deliberate destruction, purposeful destruction, is something that is a case of political failure by us humans that really could be solved tomorrow and needs to be solved yesterday.
Brian, if you could give me the final word, because I have to leave. I have to pick my kids from the school, and I'm so thankful for your kind invitation and for Dean for recommending my name as well to participate in this talk. Frankly speaking, I think the uniqueness of the book and the beauty of the book will happen maybe 10 or 15 or 20 years later, when someone will hold the book in his hand or in her hands, and we'll find that some practitioners, I mean scholars, designers, architects, planners, try to do something. I mean, rather than to talk about the problems and to keep talking about the problems and putting Gaza such as, I mean, in this kind of infographic, I mean, charts and numbers, that there were a group of people led by the late Michael Sirkin who tried to do something and to deal with the realities and to imagine a better future for the free people in Gaza, and for the free Gaza and the free Palestine. Thank you, Brian.
Well, thank you so much for being on. It was a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. Thank you, Dean. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
So, Dean, there was a couple other concepts I wanted to go through, though. So sure. You had just talked about the engineering and the skill that kind of resides there. And so one thing I'd again, my own personal interest, is, you know, so there, it's hard to get things in and out. It's hard to move things around. And yet people are still doing it. And so you had kind of hinted at a big engineering marvel that's kind of going on is their tunnel system, one that I personally had no knowledge of before. So I think our listeners would love to hear more about the fact that people are literally using tunnels to move around.
Yeah, so the tunnel system is, I think, for all us urban geographers, architects, designers, it captures the imagination.
Absolutely.
And there, you know, are all sorts of stories in the media that you can look up as well of KFC being delivered through these tunnels from the Egyptian side of the border to the Gaza, and Ferraris or luxury cars being taken through these tunnels, and also cattle, all sorts of things. They are intricate and highly complex engineering feat that also have an incredible political, social organization as well behind them, with different political groups and family factions that negotiate over who can operate tunnels and how. One of the contributors in the book details four different types of tunnels. You know, yes. One in which she can walk through completely upright and unheeded, and another one she has to crawl through, and the different qualities of the tunnels, that some being, quite rickshaw, and others, you know, with kind of almost air conditioned units kind of fitted into them. So yeah, I think that this is also a fascinating fact. And just going back to the larger point of the urbanization of warfare and conflict, you know, we've seen this, the vast tunnelizations that have gone on across this border region of Rafah and Egypt and into Gaza, changing that landscape at the subterranean level. And we've also seen similar things in Syria, of vast tunnel networks being built for shelter, people going to school and hospitals to avoid being targeted, and also habitation to then actively going in conflict, because the subterranean remains one of the sole spaces that military technologies, you know, find difficult to locate and block. So, you know, you see resistance, if you like, tunneling and that kind of survival mechanism changing the landscape. And, you know, this is, of course, a long-term thing in Vietnam, of course. The right. Tunnels were also a very famous part of the conflict there.
And so, you know, as I said, there's quite a bit in here to digest. So I would urge everyone to read it. And so you had, you know, when, as I'm closing these, I always like to hear, and you had already hinted at it, you know, so since the book's come out, you know, what have you been working on? What maybe has changed from the book? And I already asked about, you know, how has it been since 2020?
Yeah, I mean, well, firstly, you know, we also lost Michael Sorkin to COVID in yes. March 2020, and that was a huge loss to the architectural community, and me personally, as someone, you know, who was very much under the stewardship of Michael, he's been a huge mentor to me personally. But you know, Michael was a community builder, and the Terraform community remains strong, and there are a series of events that are going to carry on Michael's legacy. And his writings only grow more relevant by the day, if that would be his writings around spatial justice and the right to the city in New York, where, you know, questions like Hudson Yards are only becoming more pressing, and public and affordable housing and spatial inequalities in this city are only growing. And so his writings are, as I say, only growing more relevant. And of course, this work of Open Gaza that he and I just released, you know, the question of Palestine and Israel-Palestine and relations with America, and how we understand and engage contexts like this, really is a pressing issue. And we wait to see what Biden will do in this new administration, and if there will be actually a change in tone and connection between this region of the world from the Trump era, which I think progressives around the world and architectural community has a lot to play in terms of how we engage this context and think about it. And I hope this book also evidences how designers and social scientists can combine and collaborate to produce political interventions that are hopeful, progressive, and meaningful in terms of their ability to impact what goes on the ground. And there is no more important question for Gazans and Palestinians than questions of space and the built environment and shelter and being able to claim their right to the city. So that, I hope, gives a broad outline of how I see Open Gaza going forward. It was originally imagined that there would be an exhibition in Gaza and in London and many other places around the world to highlight some of the many illustrations and imaginations that are in the book. COVID has obviously
stymied
that in many ways, but it is still very much an ambition. There are many talks going on around this book. One is going to be at my home institution at the LSE with Salim on March 18th. There's plans to be conferences at the University of Westminster, at Harvard University in later in this year. And, you know, one of the probably the most regrettable things as well with this book is not being able to show people this physical artifact. You know, Michael also had this publishing company of Urban Research and was very dedicated to the materiality of the book. And I really hope and think we have achieved a argument and demand for the importance of books of in their material form, because it is a remarkable thing to hold, to flip through. It captures the imagination in its materiality as well. And I really do and can't wait to share that aspect with people. And so another reason why I very much encourage your listeners to purchase the book as well.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to thank you for being on. Salim as well. Unfortunately, he wasn't here towards the end. The book is Open Gaza, Architectures of Hope. Dean, I want to thank you for being on here today.
No, thank you, Brian. It's really a pleasure.
And to all my listeners. Salim, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And to all my listeners, thank you and have a great day.